So let me start off with China's maritime ambitions and maritime Silk Road. How many of you have heard of maritime Silk Road, or have you not heard of maritime Silk Road? I should ask this question. How many of you have not heard of maritime Silk Road? Don't know what it is all about. You don't?
Heard Silk Road, but not maritime.
Maritime Silk Road, okay, all right. Anyone else, folks? Okay, here's an outline of what we're going to be talking about. As I said, this is not a lecture followed by Q&A. Please feel free to make comments, stop me, interject me, and ask questions. If I'm saying something that is not clear to you, please raise your hand. This is what I'm going to be, this is my plan, what I'm going to be talking about. These countries you should be able to recognize, those countries. Pakistan, Myanmar, Sri Lanka, Kenya, Cambodia. Here's my bottom line up front. China's maritime strategy is essentially a geopolitical and geoeconomic strategy. It's not new, by the way. It is made out to be new. President Xi Jinping's mega project, his vision, but it builds upon several initiatives that have been taken over the last two or three decades by his predecessors. Great Western Development, Xi Ta Fa Chan, that was very popular under Jiang Zemin in the 90s. Hu Jintao, go global, go west. So, three Souths, Sanya strategy, South China Sea, Southeast Asia, South Asia. So this One Belt, One Road builds upon earlier initiatives by successive Chinese leaders. It's not that old, or it's not that new, I should say. It's pretty old. This reflects Beijing's quest for resources, markets, and bases that I touched upon in my plenary presentation. That's what drives it. One Belt, One Road, also now called, in Chinese, it is still called One Belt, One Road, Yi Tai Yi Lu. But in English, the name has been changed to Belt and Road Initiative. So I'm going to be focusing not on Silk Road Economic Belt that goes through Central Asia, Eurasian continent, all the way to Europe. I'm going to be focusing on China's Maritime Silk Road. This is also seen as Beijing's hub and spokes economic system as a counter to US hub and spokes security system. US has alliances with a number of countries. That's known as, in the Asia Pacific, that's known as US hub and spokes security system. So this is China's economic hub and spokes system. China is trying to build a community of common destiny. It's also, critics call it an empire of exclusive economic enclaves, those of you who haven't signed this. But China now faces intense competition, opposition from other players in the Asia Pacific that have their own ambitions, own designs. If you are in China, you look outward, that's how you're sitting here in Beijing or Shanghai. You look outward, that's how it looks like. US forces in South Korea, alliances, US alliances, hub and spoke system, Japan, Philippines, ties with Taiwan. So this is what the Chinese call C-shaped containment. So China has to break free of this C-shaped containment and encirclement by US friends and allies. And the Malacca dilemma that Hu Jintao talked about in 2004, because you've all been to Arizona War Memorial, right? One reason Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, a major reason Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, was the US blockade of Japan's oil and gas supplies from Indonesian oil fields. So China worries about a potential oil blockade, though Japan's geography was very different. You know, it's an insular island nation. China is a continental power. But Chinese have talked about worst-case scenario of oil blockade in the event of a crisis across the Taiwan Straits or the South China Sea. So that's where it comes from, China's siege mentality. China's foreign policy, China's maritime strategy, is based on what I call the G2 narrative. It's not Brzezinski's G2 shared hegemony, US-China shared hegemony or condominium, but here it means grievances and grandeur, narrative of historical grievances and imperial grandeur. So that book I showed you here, China's Asian Dream, that's this one. This is a book written by Liu Mengfu, a PLA colonel, before Xi Jinping adopted this slogan of the China Dream. And this book by a journalist, Tom Miller, talks about China's Asian Dream. That's what One Belt, One Road is all about. And this one, we organized a conference here. Yixian Liang, who is now a Chinese ambassador to Sri Lanka, he participated in this workshop in this very room we organized about, time goes by very fast, 5 years ago, 2013, Maritime Security in the Indo-Pacific, American, Chinese, and Indian Perspectives. You all familiar with Admiral Cheng He's 15th century naval expeditions? Anyone who has not heard of Cheng He or Cheng Ho, as he is called in Southeast Asia? You all familiar with that, right? Okay. So the goal is to rebuild China's navy as the largest, most powerful navy. Far Seas Defense, Yuan Hai Guofang, and the rise of hawkish admirals we have seen. Wu Shengli, Shen Jinlong, who is the chief of Chinese Navy currently, Yuan Yupai, Southern Theater Command. He heads that command, Southern Theater, that covers Fujian and South China Sea. And this is part of China's two ocean naval strategy. It's been talked about for more than two decades now. Since the early 90s, we have heard of this talk of two ocean naval strategy. This map takes you back into history. As you can see, it's not just Xi Jinping who has a dream. Chiang Kai-shek also had a dream. When China was ruled by the nationalist Kuomintang that fled to Taiwan. This is how China existed in reality in 1938. When Chiang Kai-shek did not even control the heartland of China, you know, China was occupied by European powers, Japan, Manchuria, you know, Manchukuo was set up by the Japanese. Chiang Kai-shek's cartographers were very busy drawing maps that bore no resemblance to reality at that time. So this was Chiang Kai-shek's dream in 1938. He showed all these countries as part of China's lost territories that should be returned to China. That map has been now reproduced. Grandeur. We talked about grievances, right? Historical grievances that China lost, was colonized, conquered. This is the official version in terms of why China has unveiled this One Belt, One Road, Maritime Silk Road, and what actually happened in history. Cheng He's, there is one official version of Cheng He, which was all about commerce, trade, exchange of gifts, no political intent. But the reality of Cheng He's naval expeditions, as per historians. Two contrasting narratives. Before I move on to the present, any questions, comments, folks, you want to ask, any observations on what I have said so far? Now, everything is clear? Okay. Maginot Line in the Pacific. This was the trench warfare, World War I, French journals, line drawn in the European theater. So China is building a great wall at sea. Since 2010, South China Sea is no longer a seascape. It's China's blue national soil. Chungko de lan thu ti in Chinese. It's landscape now. It's not even seascape. You like the cartoon? ASEAN is trying to persuade China to adhere to a code of conduct since the early 2000s. It's still going on. This map shows that up until 1950s, China did not even control the Paracels Islands. Where China was in the 50s and where it is today. Over the last 70 years, China has made tremendous progress, especially since 1974. 1 year before the fall of Saigon, the end of Vietnam War, China occupied the Paracel Islands. Then came 1988, clashes with the Vietnamese. Many Vietnamese were killed, occupied some Spratly Islands, seized from Vietnam that were under Vietnamese control. 1995, Mischief Reef, fisherman's shelter that was supposed to be built by, as per Chinese Foreign Minister Chen Qichun at that time. Now it's a full-fledged military base. So China's salami slicing, cabbage strategy has succeeded beyond anyone's imagination, you know. So why would China go to war with any country when this strategy has succeeded beyond strategists, you know, imagination, has paid rich dividends. This is what is known as gray zone competition. This is at the time of lifting of the ban on fishing that's imposed in the South China Sea. China's navy is different from most of your country's navies. Most of your country's navies are two-legged navies. You have Coast Guard, right? White ships, and then you have gray ships. China's navy is four-legged navy. It has four components: Navy, Coast Guard, Maritime Militia, and Fisherman's Fleet that are given the task of enforcing China's maritime claims, sovereignty claims, you know, whether it's in the East China Sea or in the South China Sea. So that's a crucial difference between your navies and China's navies. This graphic shows that the intensifying competition. Now China is being called as a near peer competitor of the US. If you look at the numbers alone do not tell you the whole story, you know. Make no mistake, in terms of overall balance of power, US friends and allies retain that edge over China in terms of pure military balance of power. Have no doubt about it. But as Stalin said, quantity has a quality of its own, right? Numbers do make a lot of difference. And the quality of weapon systems comes into play only in wartime. China does not want to fight, especially not the US, not Japan. It may get into fights with Philippines or Vietnam. The Chinese don't want to avoid, they want to avoid war with the US and Japan. So the quality of weapon systems does not come into play. In peacetime, numbers matter, and numbers work to China's advantage. So having the largest navy, showing the flag, brings about a shift in the regional perceptions that your economic and military balance of power is shifting. Better look north to China for your security instead of across the Pacific to the US for your security. So this is the purpose of having the largest navy, you know. 16 ships, all kinds of naval vessels were added over the last 2.5 years to China's navy. China is going to have the largest number of submarines, largest submarine fleet. So So Chinese strategists see US dominance of the international system as an historical aberration, which will eventually give way to a Sino-centric order. By 2020, China is expected to become the world's second largest navy, and by 2030, it will have more ships and submarines than the US Navy, even despite, you know, Trump's promise to augment US naval power in terms of numbers alone. And I give you some quotes from Admiral In Chuo and Xu Guangyu, who say that China needs two carrier strike groups in the West Pacific Ocean and two in the Indian Ocean. So China is working to build a fleet of carrier battle groups, 5 to 6 aircraft carriers. And China needs 10 to 20 ports around the world in all oceans and continents. Ambitions, we're talking about ambitions here. Everything depends on, of course, you know, continued economic growth. Only then you have those resources to put into military buildup. So this is Liu Huaqing's strategy in the early 80s. He was chief of Chinese Navy, also called China's Admiral Gorshkov, who came up with a blueprint, and that was the blueprint. Area denial in the first island chain of defense. By 2020, if you read PACOM commander's you know, testimony, the one who has been nominated, Admiral Davidson, who says that China has a quiet shot of war, not just sea denial, but sea control through its artificial islands, militarization of artificial islands. That's a strategy, that's a blueprint. Whether China will get there, we don't know, but that's where they're coming from, that's where they want to go. So OBOR, I mentioned this in my plenary presentation of BRI. What is it? There are three different views on One Belt, One Road or Belt and Road Initiative. One is that it's China's Marshall Plan, like post-World War II reconstruction of Western Europe by the US, Marshall Plan. But this is, multiply that by several times, you know, in terms of money that China wants to invest, you know, $1 trillion to $4 trillion on building railroads, pipelines, ports, infrastructure projects, you know, in throughout the Indo-Pacific, from Africa to East Asia. Is it a blueprint for a post-American Sino-centric order? Or is it China's imperial overreach at a time when China's you know, domestic debt is 250 times the size of its GDP. China's GDP is $12 trillion, or $13 trillion, and its debt, domestic debt, is more than $30 trillion. And economic growth is slowing down. Time will tell what it is, but there are three different views. And this, I'm sorry about this font size. There is a chart on 10 largest recipients of Chinese official overseas funding: Russia, Pakistan, Angola, Laos, Venezuela, Turkmenistan, Ecuador, Brazil, Sri Lanka, and Kazakhstan. These are the countries that have received largest amounts of money. But there are some that are not listed here, like Bolivia, $15 billion China lost. $50 billion, 15 lost in Bolivia. $20 billion in Libya, post-Gaddafi, you know, China lost. $60 billion China is supposed to have lost in Venezuela. Well, it had committed, it had invested, it had promised to underwrite the economic growth of these countries. And because of political change, government's regime change, leaders were overthrown, so that money has gone down the drain. So they're trying to renegotiate terms of repayment through commodities. In Venezuela's case, heavy oil. If they don't get that money, then they've lost it. So huge amounts of money. This slide further illustrates. Two-thirds of the world's top 50 ports are either owned by China or have received some Chinese investment. China is truly a global power, global maritime power. It's not just about the Asia-Pacific region. And I'll next couple of slides will show you. These are key projects that China is investing in. Malaysia, Southeast Asia, railroads, though the only high-speed railway that's under construction is the one that that is in Laos. All other projects are on the back burner at the moment. The one in Indonesia or Thailand, because of differences over interest rates, Thai government thought that 3.99% interest rate was too high, while Indonesia was being charged 2%. So they put the project on the back burner. They have tried to, there have been reports of reviving it, renegotiating interest rate for that project, but discussions remain bogged down. So only one high-speed railway that's under construction is the one in Laos. And that's going to cost $6 to $7 billion. That may lead to high indebtedness. You know, Laos might, it would be 65% of Laotian economy, that whole project. All this talk of building a canal, you know, rival to Panama Canal has just disappeared. A Chinese Hong Kong businessman based in Hong Kong who promised to build, you know, this canal through Nicaragua, he lost after the collapse of the stock market in 2015, 2016. His personal wealth went down from $13 billion to $3 billion. And Panama has now switched allegiance from Taiwan to China. So all this talk of building a rival to Panama Canal has died down because Panama has switched diplomatic allegiance from Taiwan to China. So there is not much incentive for China to build that canal. There was a lot of domestic opposition to that. The government over there wanted China to come and build, but it's not going to be built. So that project, you can forget about it. Kunming, Singapore train, it still remains very much on the drawing board. That's Bangladesh, China, India, Myanmar corridor. Parts of it are being built, but this is a project that's going to take decades because of regional tensions. And this is a Krak Canal. How many of you are here from Thailand? No? You know, this project of building an Asian version of Krak Canal has been talked about for almost 100 years. But it hasn't happened. China has offered to build it for $20 billion. There have been media reports of an MOU being signed, but the Thai government has dismissed those media reports. A major reason, though it makes sense for Thailand, economically it makes perfect sense, you know, for Thailand to build this canal, Krak Canal. The problem is that there's a, what makes sense economically, geopolitically, it doesn't. Thailand, as you know, is a Buddhist country largely, right? But in the southern provinces, they are faced with insurgency. Pachani Kingdom that was annexed by the Kingdom of Siam, that is Thailand today, in the 19th century. There was used to be an Islamic kingdom, Pachani Kingdom, north of Malaysia, south of Thailand, that became part of Thailand. That's where they are waging PULO. Pachani United Liberation Organization is waging a war, insurgency for a separate Islamic state. So every Thai prime minister has been advised by his intel chief not to give green light to this project because instead of reaping any financial rewards from this project, Thailand may see the loss of that territory, dismemberment, partition of Thailand if this canal is built. So that religious fault line that exists within Thailand comes in the way of building this Kraw Canal. So it's going to remain a pipe dream, it's not going to be built in the near future. These are the two countries that have received a lot of Chinese investment. In Pakistan's case, we hear from $46 billion, it's gone up to $64 billion. There's a $64 billion question whether it will all be spent in Pakistan. And Myanmar, Burma, has received huge investment. These are oil pipelines that is now operational, though it's not working to its full capacity, only 40% capacity. And railway project, railroad from all the way. China has completed its work on railroad, up to the border of China-Myanmar border, but Myanmar has suspended that project. And China is building this Chakpu port where you have this Rakhine State Rohingya problem too. That's $10 billion worth of project. So these two countries are the largest recipients. That's why some Chinese strategists have talked about China's West Coast. Just as the US has East Coast and West Coast, Burma and Pakistan are seen as China's West Coast. This map shows China's Djibouti base and Maldives that has been in the news. Anyone from Maldives here? No? Okay. So let me talk very briefly about the economic dimension, then I'll stop and give you time to ask any questions or make any comments. I think I've said enough to provoke you. Asia's economies, as you know, are very closely integrated with the Chinese Chinese economy. You can look at the figures in terms of bilateral trade, where it was in 2003 and where it is today. $60 billion to $500 billion in 2015. It's gone up. That's the figure I need to update. How many of you have heard of Lenin's imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism? It was a booklet. That's what led to the Russian Revolution, October Revolution, the spread of communism. That capitalist surpluses lead to overseas search for resources, markets, and bases. Resources, markets, and bases. They always go together. You cannot have one without the other. And that's what is driving this. Of course, you cannot colonize these days. In the good old days, European countries would go and occupy countries, right? That's how we saw this colonization of Asia, Africa, Latin America. You can't do that anymore. So the next best option is to have friendly, pliant regimes that will do your bidding. That's the competition that's going on. Having friendly, pliant regimes in resource-rich countries, strategically located countries near choke points, maritime choke points. That's the great game that's being played out. China has many comparative advantages. I list a couple of them. China's reputation in building infrastructure projects in a very short period of time. 348 railway projects China has all over the world. Chinese companies have all over the world. Creating artificial islands. Some of these island states are going to disappear. If you live in the Maldives, Mauritius, Solomon Islands, Tuvalu, Vanuatu, yeah, you would invite the Chinese companies in. Come and invest. If they are going to disappear with the rising sea levels, global warming, why not create artificial islands? And China has proven technological capability to do that, right? Japanese used to be good at that too, but China has overtaken Japan in that. There used to be a joke in the 80s, 90s, whenever Japan wants to increase its GDP by 1%, it will start pouring concrete into the ocean to expand its land mass. Now China is doing that. So these are corridors, corridors of Belt and Road. Yes. As I said before, I think it was in my plenary presentation that China is not doing anything that other rising industrializing powers have not done before. So it's not new. The new great game is actually very old. China has surplus capital, China has overcapacity, and it is exporting that to other countries. It works to both. If you have, you know, countries like Kenya, for example, you know, Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, that do not even have roads, bridges, Cambodia, infrastructure to speak of. Why? Because Western multinational corporations concerned about their quarterly shareholders' profits, or their shareholders' quarterly profits, would not go and invest in those countries because the risk factor is too high. Their shareholders will not let them invest in conflict-prone countries that are just coming out of civil wars. Nobody will go and invest. China is going into those countries. Angola, Sudan, you know, Ethiopia, Eritrea, Afghanistan, Cambodia, Pakistan, Sri Lanka. So these are countries that welcome Chinese investments, you know. It works to their advantage. So economic gain, I mean, if you look at historically, bandwagoning with an economic superpower does bring about change in the fortunes of those countries, provided they can play it to their, work it to their advantage. If that money is cornered by the ruling elites in those countries, Hun Sen pockets, you know, 90% of money that comes from China, then that's not going to lead to sustainable development of Cambodia. Let's face it. And that's true of all countries. So it all depends on if you have the kind of institutions, leaderships in those countries that can take advantage of China's economic generosity, so to speak, you know. If you don't, then you're going to end up as a loser. So whether there are benefits or positives and negatives, they are always to foreign investment, letting foreign countries coming in. If you can play those to your advantage, it's good for you, for your country, for economic growth. Pakistan has experienced, for example, 5-6% growth rate, very high growth rate because of Chinese investment. $25 billion Chinese have invested to date in a number of projects in Pakistan. Whether that can be sustained over a long period of time, we don't know. It all depends on that country's leadership, domestic policies, institutions. So sustainable development is one thing. Getting this huge dose of money in a short period of time, that has happened to other countries too. And then we have seen all these countries carrying, you know, begging bowl to the IMF and World Bank. Whether that these countries will end up there, we don't know. Time will tell. So while we welcome, you know, the countries that have underdeveloped economies, they welcome, whether it is Chinese money or Japanese money or any other country's money, you know, to develop. But you have to be very careful in terms of what kind of deals you are entering into, whether they're going to work to your advantage or not. So let me talk about the maritime dimension. We talked about economic dimension. There are three dimensions here, two major dimensions here, economic and geostrategic or maritime dimension. This string of pearls, how many of you had heard of string of pearls? Please raise your hand. Not many. This was a document that came out in 2003. I had contributed to that, done for US Defense Department, Energy Futures in Asia, based on what was going on. And I'll show you a slide, similarities between the two, Maritime Silk Road and String of Pearls, that China is going to acquire bases to secure its sea lanes of communication. PLA presence at four maritime choke points, Walvis Bay, Namibia, Djibouti, Gwadar, Malacca. That's in Malaysia. China is building a big city, big port in Malacca. $99 lease on Cambodia. 20% of Cambodian coastline is leased to one Chinese company based in Tianjin, United Development Group. Only one company. Some estimates show that 30% of Cambodian coastline is now leased to China for 99 years. Sri Lanka, Hambantota Port, Pakistan Gwadar Port deal is 40 years. Djibouti is 15 years, I believe. Myanmar, China is asking for Chakpu port lease 99 years. It has raised its stake from 50% to 75%. Maldives, there are talks, you know, there's one island that China has leased for 50 years. And this is, this strategy shows sea control in the South China Sea would enable sea denial in the Indian Ocean. That's the strategy in terms of maritime strategy. And this leads to competition between, ignites, fuels geopolitical competition between China and rival powers, India and Japan. Sea denial, having the capability to prevent other countries. You saw recently when Australian warships sailed into the South China Sea, they were warned to get out of the South China Sea. That's called sea denial. That if they want to, if Chinese Navy has the capability, if they want to prevent other navies from sending warships to the South China Sea, they now have the capability to do so. Before, they did not have the capability. So that's what it means. Deny sea to other navies. Yes? Yeah, those EEZ that China claims that that's Chinese EEZ, and other countries do not recognize that as China's EEZ. Yes, not on the high seas. That's true. So this slide shows a string of pearls projects, and there is a similarity between maritime Silk Road projects. This slide gives you more detailed information about a few countries. One of the, there are two studies that came out this month alone. Harvard Ambitions that I've circulated here, you can pass it on, and CSIS report. So this graphic, Harvard Ambitions has very good graphics, you know. So I downloaded this graphic from C4Ed's Harvard Ambitions. Beautiful graphics. From those two studies, both CSIS study and on Maritime Silk Road and Harvard Ambitions. So if you don't agree with any maps, graphics, I'm not a cartographer, I don't draw this, I just download, blame it all on Mr. Google, you know. I Google them. I just add my text is mine, but not graphics. So China is a global maritime power, as you can see now. From this graphic, this is from Financial Times, London, newspaper story, main story in the Financial Times. Ports that have been used for resupply in Chinese naval deployments are listed in the top one. And dual use commercial naval ports are shown in the bottom map. This is a major criticism of China's Belt and Road Initiative, you know. There are positives, but there are also negatives. It's like yin and yang. Countries that have offered bases, commercial ports to China on long-term lease also happen to be countries that find themselves in debt because of investments in infrastructure projects. So this was a very scathing criticism by an Australian minister for Pacific Affairs. for a specific island, small states. So it's called the debt trap. This is, recently, only last week, about 27 out of 28 countries in the European Union, ambassadors from 27 countries based in Beijing issued a statement, with the exception of Hungary. That's where China is building high-speed railway. So excluding Hungary, 27 European countries criticized Belt and Road Initiative. As I see it, in Europe and where it is leading to. Greece, the Czech Republic, Hungary, Serbia, Moldova, and Macedonia. These countries have received huge investment as part of Belt and Road Initiative. It brings about a shift in the domestic politics. Despite this non-interference in domestic affairs, we have seen where China invests, pours so much money into those countries, whether it is in Cambodia or Sri Lanka, it brings about a shift in civil-military relations in favor of strongman politics, because authoritarian leaders, they can deliver. Democratic regimes, they come and go and they upset calculations, long-term investments. They are not good, whether they are for multinational. That's why many Western multinational corporations also used to favor countries with strong leaders, authoritarian regimes. So it's not just China. Many multinational corporations, Western or Chinese, would like to have political stability in countries where they invest, pour such huge amounts of money. They want good return on investment, ROI. So they like political stability. Leaders who can provide stability will remain in power for a long period of time. So it's not just uniquely Chinese characteristics. Many Western corporations have been accused of the same thing too. Bribing politicians, interfering in domestic politics. Now, talking about problems that exist, in terms of the major problem is that most of these countries I mentioned before, are rated as junk, below investment grade. So not many countries would go and invest in those countries, especially the ones in pink. So this is a major stumbling block. This is where there's this talk of, Belt and Road Initiative becoming China's imperial overreach, where China might lose lots of money that's pouring into those countries. So high risk investments, these are very high risk investments. Then many of these projects go through contested territories. Territorial disputes, for example, maritime disputes. China's rivals like US, Japan, Australia, India are capitalizing on this impression that China is pursuing mercantilist policies and exploiting mistrust of China's economic policies to their own advantage. So China faces intense competition. Excuse me. To counter China's One Belt, One Road initiative, Japan has come up with Asia-Africa Growth Corridor. Japan and India jointly unveiled this. Indonesia talks about being a global maritime fulcrum in the Indo-Pacific, because Indonesia, like Australia, is a quintessentially Indo-Pacific nation. It straddles both the Pacific Ocean and the Indian Ocean. And the resurrected Quad, it has met two or three times, and they've talked about, their own connectivity projects. Let me first talk about what Japan is doing. Shinzo Abe unveiled, $110 billion Partnership for Quality Infrastructure initiative to counter China's Belt and Road Initiative. The emphasis is on quality, that Japan builds quality infrastructure and China does not. So Japan is capitalizing on that. PQR, it's called, with low interest rates. And Japan was, before China set up its military base in Djibouti, it was Japan that set up its first post-World War II overseas naval base in Djibouti. China came later. Japan has intensified cooperation, naval cooperation, defense cooperation agreements. It has signed with Australia, India, and it's negotiating with the Philippines and Vietnam. I think Philippines, they have signed some kind of MOU. And Japan is funding this east-west. China is building north-south corridors, railroads. Japan is countering that with east-west connectivity from Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia to Myanmar. It works to this country's advantage, right? Japanese competition works to this country's advantage. Playing both sides. So this is a tug of war going on between China and Japan over building infrastructure, ports especially, in different parts of the Asia Pacific. Competition is always good. It benefits small and middle powers. They can play both sides to extract, you know, benefits, economic, strategic benefits. Japan, according to Nikkei Asian Weekly, is now leading a maritime coalition against China. And these are countries that have received special attention from Prime Minister Abe. And I list here what Abe has promised during his visits to Indonesia, Sri Lanka, and the Philippines. Duterte is, of course, quoting both China and Japan, as you can see, Xi Jinping and Prime Minister Abe. Japan is building a number of ports in the Indo-Pacific, listed here. JICA stands for Japan International Cooperation Agency. Next is India's opposition. India was the only country that publicly opposed, boycotted the Belt and Road Forum that was held last year. And it has come up with its own project for the Indian Ocean littorals as a counter to Xi Jinping's Asia for Asians. Indian Prime Minister talked about Indian Ocean for those who live in the Indian Ocean region. So there is this Belt and Road Initiative has fueled geopolitical competition amongst regional heavyweights. India and Japan on the one side, China on the other side. LOMOA stands for Logistic Exchange Memorandum of Agreements that Indian Navy has signed to gain access to American and French naval bases in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. Diego Garcia reunion, Mozambique, in the Indian Ocean, the French bases and US bases. So that's a flanking maneuver. Very interesting. Geopolitics is like sports, you know. What is it about? It's about countries, great powers, engaged in this daily intense competition to gain relative advantage over the other. One day one is losing, the other day the other one is winning, you know, or losing. So it's a tug of war going on amongst these players, you know, to have influence in small and medium-sized countries. Your location matters. Your location is very important. So these are islands that now Indian Navy can access that are owned by the French. As a result of this agreement, India and France have signed recently. That gives an edge to Indian Navy over the Chinese Navy. But it's not over. China has very deep pockets. Japan and India do not have those deep pockets. So if you look at this graphic here, What India has offered to these countries may be loose pocket change from China's perspective. China is spending trillions of dollars, you know, offering deep $25 billion here, $30 billion here, $64 billion there. So this is just loose pocket change. But the fact that China's Belt and Road Initiative has galvanized, forced countries like Japan, India, even the US to start investing in those countries is a good thing, right? That's a positive. If China had not come up with this initiative, Japan, India, or US, European Union would not be doing, spending that much money in those countries. So competition is good. It works to your advantage. Most of you come from small and middle powers. It works to your advantage, provided you have the right mix of policies, institutions to make good use of those investments in your countries. So nine dash line, China, India has drawn these blue lines along the northern Indian Ocean. Very interesting game going on between these two countries. And this is a connectivity game that's being played out here between India is building those east-west corridors that complement, reinforce Japan's emphasis on building east-west corridors. Some of these are funded by Asian Development Bank. That's Japanese, you know, dominated bank, Asian Development Bank. So, summing up, in terms of obstacles, money may not buy love and loyalty, but it can certainly buy you influence. And we have seen that in the case of Cambodia, Greece, and Hungary. So money does play a role. Move on. These are the projects that have been put on the back burner, suspended. Silk Road, China's Silk Road faces some hurdles. So will it succeed or fail? I'll give you my take toward the end, but it plays to China's advantages. This diplomacy, infrastructure diplomacy, plays to China's strengths, works to China's advantage. There's no doubt about it. It seeks to displace the US with China as the superpower in the Indo-Pacific region. Many African, Central, South, Southeast Asian countries love the project. You know, they are supporting it. They want, they're courting China proactively. 70 plus countries have signed on to this project. They all welcome Chinese money. Nobody ever says no to money offering you, right? You don't, usually don't say that. No. Hard to say, I would say, if somebody's offering you money. But others are uncomfortable with the level of high debts if it leads to debts and the loss of sovereign control. Some of these projects, as we have seen the case of Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Thailand, and other countries, they require Chinese state-owned enterprises to operate with greater sensitivity and adopt international best practices, including corporate social responsibility. Actually, CITIC is now building hospitals and schools in Myanmar's Rakhine province. They faced a lot of opposition with a change in regime in Myanmar. They realized, you know, they need to not just deal with generals, military in Burma, but politicians, civil society, groups, NGOs, build schools, hospitals, railroads for the benefit of local population, generate employment opportunities. So they're trying to win hearts and minds with some of these projects, especially in Pakistan, Myanmar, Cambodia, these three countries. I don't know much about Africa. I guess the same thing is happening in Africa too. But there has been a change in their, you know, work practices of China's multinational corporations. Japan, India, US, and post-Putin Russia could create major problems if China fails to get their support. These are the conditions that these countries, known as the Quad, that's US, Japan, Australia, and India, have put forward, that they will support OBOR only if it generates employment, good governance, leads to good governance, open competitive bidding. So far, in most, there's a recent study done by Bloomberg. It shows that in all these Belt and Road projects, 90%, 89.7% of these projects have gone to Chinese companies. Only 10% have gone to local or other companies. So open competitive bidding would involve the participation of all, you know, companies, whoever has the best expertise, or, you know, bid to compete with others, not just Chinese companies. So that's a condition. And environmentally friendly, it should be environmentally friendly. What do I mean by OBOR needs OBOR? One Belt, One Road to be successful needs order based on rules. We need to agree on certain rules of the road in terms of project finance, infrastructure financing. We need to have some common internationally accepted standards. So order based on rules will make One Belt, One Road successful. If successful, China is a major winner. My take is that this project is too big to fail completely. It cannot completely fail. So even if half of these projects are built, implemented, China can claim success come 2049. That's the target year as per the Chinese government, and claim that mission has been accomplished. So the project is too big to fail. That's my take on this. But it's based on the assumption that China's economy will continue to do well. If China faces a major economic crisis, all bets are off. If China continues to sustain a growth rate of 5 to 6%, then China can achieve those objectives and declare success in 2049. If not, then it will be seen as China's imperial overreach. Just as the Soviet Union was seen very expansive, expansionist in the late 70s, early 80s. It was all over Angola, Afghanistan, and then we saw what happened to the Soviet Union. So it all boils down to the economy, economic strength. So Asia's maritime future, talking about the last point, bullet point, will resemble its past. If you look at this graphic here, in the good old days, it used to be, there used to be many roads, not one road, one belt, many. Silk, spice, cotton roads, you know. So one thing we can be certain about the future is that there'll be many roads. That's what US, Japan, India are doing, building other roads, you know. So that will complement this. That's how it will look like. Not, there won't be just one belt, one road. That we can be sure of. This is China's vision. I show you some graphics. It's not just China's vision of connectivity. There are other countries too that will come up with their own visions of connectivity. All these graphics are from CSIS study. This is India's vision. No, China talks about world order should not be decided by one country, meaning the US. India talks about Asian order should not be decided by one country, meaning China. That's Japan's vision of closer integration of South and Southeast Asia. Then you have Russia's and South Korea's vision too. So there are several visions. It's a clash of dreams. There's not just one dream. Believe it or not, Turkey and Iran have their own visions of connectivity. So, what does it mean for the foreseeable future in the next 10, 15 years? You're going to see this competition and cooperation between two rival blocs. Shanghai Cooperation Organization countries, BRI countries, and then what I call COD, the Coalition of Democracies at the global level. EU, US, Japan, India, Australia, you know, two different visions of maritime future. Like iPod, I call it iQuad. Inclusive Quad, because Canada, I was at a conference recently in Ottawa in Canada. Canada wants to be part of the Quad, then it can't be called Quad, right? If you have more than four countries, then you're not part of Quad. And France, UK, Indonesia, Vietnam have expressed support for the Quad. So I call it Inclusive Quad, iQuad, like iPod. Okay, that ends my presentation. That's Chung Ho.